most people who become environmentalists have an awakening or an aha movement. And I'd grown up as an Ohio boy and in a pleasant family and a very Republican family, by the way. And then I went to law. I went to school on the East Coast, and I went to law school at the University of Michigan. And so the reason I'm here now talking is because I did not like my first year in law school very much. And I survived it, but I didn't like it. So I wanted to get a summer job doing anything but going back to Columbus being an apprentice lawyer or something. So I went across the street and got a summer job in a place called Glacier National Park at one of the hotels, Many Glacier Hotel. And I thought, well, you know, that must be in Alaska someplace. That's a good far away because I had glaciers in it. And I'll never forget the experience going on the train, going Minneapolis across the Dakotas and then in eastern Montana. And 24 hours later, I woke up and we're clickety-clack, still going west. And I went up to the observation dome into the old Great Northern and sat next to an older guy. He probably was about 30 or so. And I said, my goodness, sir, those clouds are certainly low on the mountain, on the horizon out there. He says, them ain't clouds on them's the Rocky Mountains. Oh, my God. And so the moment I stepped off the train at East Glacier Park, there were the great peaks rising right out of the prairies and the ice-pure creeks tumbling down from the heavens. You could feel them and the sweet smell of the pines. And it was like some old lost chord was plucked inside the deepest part of me, and it sang a song. And the song has been singing ever since. This is your home. This is your home. Come here. So then it was only a question of surviving law school, and which I did, and then moving out west. Decided not to come to Montana. It was cheaper to take the bar exam in Seattle than any other place then. So, and they had two mountain ranges, one on either side. So that's what I was there for. So we went there. My wife was from Boston, so they had salt water in the middle. And we just made our home there. And I was really happy for a while. And this is part of the story. And I took the climbing course, and I climbed everywhere, and I was so happy. And then all at once I realized something really wrong was going on out there in the National Forest. They were logging all these places I would dream about all in one summer and go there with nothing but a big pile of down ancient forest, big trees of jackstraws of mud and slice. And I got very unhappy, and so I became a passionate conservationist when I was in the 60s.
And you really got into the movement before there was a movement in some ways, because none of the federal legislation had been passed at that point. The Wilderness Act was 1964, Endangered Species Act, and NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, all came after your awakening. You were part of the creation of those.
It's a very good point to remember, because some people get gloomy. Oh, no, these are hard times right now. Well, they're hard times, but they're always hard times if you love the earth and want to protect it. But I remind them there was a time within our lifetimes when there were no environmental laws whatsoever. Yes, there was the Wilderness Act, but that didn't protect anything. You had to get a law passed to get that. I mean, it was good, but was there? But there's no such thing as NEPA or the Endangered Species Act. You couldn't go, going to court was not an option. There was nothing there. So you had to stand and fight politically for whatever you wanted to get. And those were scary times indeed, but it also had to be the same time, as you know, that the anti-war movement and the feminist movement and civil rights movement, all these things were coming along too. And something seemed to catch the American people on fire all over the country. And we were lucky out here because the Northwest really came alive then.
Mr. Evans, I've spoken to a lot of the pioneers in the movement over the years, and some are discouraged. Mm. You're not one of them. You really see great hope in the generations to come after that they will carry the torch.
I do. And I've even written a book about it, which we might come back to. But I'm an optimist, and I tell this when I speak to student groups or others. Oh, I know you think it's all too late and too bad and so on and so on. I said, no. I said, why am I an optimist? Why am I? And some of my friends say, well, oh, Evan, you just drank too much of that Potomac River water. That's why you're an optimist. But I'm an optimist because I've lived through it, and I've witnessed it, and I've witnessed what seemed to be miracles happening, which is people taking on hopeless lost causes. Like, say, saving the Magruder Corridor right here in the Bitterroot Valley. That was hopeless. 175,000 acres going to be logged for sure. But because of a woman named Doris Miller, lives down around Hamilton, and her friends, now it's part of the wilderness area. And I've seen it again and again. And I've been involved in these campaigns all around the country now, working with wonderful people. And what I say to people is, if you don't believe me, pull out a map sometime. Pull out any kind of a map, a highway map. And look for the green areas on the map with boundaries around them. I don't mean national forests, but I mean wilderness areas and parks and state parks and national parks and wildlife refuges. There's a couple hundred million acres there now that were not there 40 years ago. and they're protected. They're protected because our country has enforceable laws. So I've seen far more protected. A lot has been messed up too, but these places are protected for good and forever, and the laws are there and they're enforceable. So I've seen it happen before, and I have great faith that the young people will carry on the banner.
You are head of the Endangered Species Coalition, and one of the biggest, it seems to me, endangered species success stories is the Rocky Mountain wolf, the restoration of that in the Northern Rockies, still highly controversial in the Northern Rockies, as you know. But that is, from endangered species standpoint, for those who advocate for saving endangered species, that really is a great success story, isn't it?
Oh, my goodness, yes. Wolves were almost extinct. They're certainly still extinct in most of the country, except in a few places. And that is a great success story that the wolf has come back. And once it's reintroduced and protected, it can get back to it's doing its normal, shall I say, ecosystem function of, you know, keeping the populations of other things down a little bit so things repair. For example, in Yellowstone, where the wolves flourish, guess what happened? The trout stream started coming back, and they got cold again because what they did was chase keep the moose and the elk moving out of the stream sides so that vegetation could grow back and make the streams colder. But anyhow, yes, the wolf is a great success story. We're a little concerned about what's going on right now, and these things have an ebb and flow to them, I think.
You have written a book. It's called Fight and Win, Brock Evans' Strategies for the New Eco-Warrior. Mr. Evans, I guess the title implies that you've learned some lessons over the years about what works and what doesn't.
It's basically the lessons I've learned over 50 years of campaigning to rescue the American Earth. And all these issues, whether you're in Florida or in Montana or Arizona, they're what I call love battles. People want to save those green places, not for any technical reason or certainly no economic gain. They do it because they love the land. And it's been my joy and my pleasure to work with these people in whatever states, wherever they are in campaigns and abroad too, to save these places. Yes, so the book is it's sort of a combination of, here's a tip. For example, if you want to go lobby, say, city supervisor or so on, research who they are first. Find out who they are. Find out what they like. You know, simple things that we think we do, but a lot of people don't. They just walk in, and then they get disappointed. Do that. Or things like that. Be sure to turn up at public hearings. But so they're little tips about what I've learned, and I tell some stories about how when we were faced with a hostile committee chairman coming in to decide whether we could get a new national park in my state, Washington, we knew he was going to try to kill the bill, so we put on a show. I hit the road for 3 months and organized, and we turned out 800 witnesses there. And the medium became, anyhow, it's things like that with my stories about how we did it.
What's your assessment of the efficacy of being adversarial versus collaborative? Because that's sort of the new watchword of the movement, is collaboration is going to get you a lot farther than, say, litigation. Do you agree with that? And do you think there is a gradual shift in that sense or not?
I personally think that to the extent there's a shift is because the anti-environment far-right legislators have become so powerful in certain places that that's the only way to get anything done, is to collaborate. I'm all for collaboration if we get something really good out of it, if all sides really get something good out of it. It would say, well, we want to collaborate over the boundaries of this proposed wilderness, and I'll take a fourth, and you take a fourth, and they'll get a fourth. Well, that means we only get a fourth of 100% that we wanted. If the collaboration is over a whole region, let's say, the whole valley or something like that, where we work out where the houses go and where the hospitals go and the shopping malls and where the wilderness goes, then everybody gets what they really need. And I'm very much in favor of listening to what the other side is saying and what they want and see if there's a way to accommodate it. And my experience has been that we can usually accommodate most things people are concerned about 80% of the time or maybe more. Then if we tried to accommodate on the Magruder Corridor, it would be log on both sides and leave a little scenic trip along the side. That's not a compromise. To me, pardon me for going on, but it's sort of like saying, well, let's collaborate. So do we want to cut your arm off of your elbow or your wrist? Which one? That's not collaboration. We've lost so much wilderness already. But if collaborate means, well, you can keep your arm as it is, but I get to do so and so and so and so too, and that's fine with me. I think you need to be an adversary and prove that you have strength before you can be a collaborator.
But always good to find common ground, isn't it? Because common ground is the most effective.
Absolutely. Thing. And if you can find common ground, that's why I come to believe that all Americans love the earth, love their land. It doesn't matter what party you are. You may have other views about the people who are advocating it, but you love it. Most people want a place to take their children and grandchildren hunting and fishing where they used to go, and they're sad when it's gone. And that's called legacy. I'll never forget a hearing I went to in Salmon, Idaho many years ago, and I was the only person advocating for a wilderness area there. But I heard rancher after farmer after rancher after business person from the local area saying, we don't want any wilderness. We want the place to stay just like it is. Well, that's the same belief system. I said, hey, yeah, we do too. So we collaborated on that. But people have to understand that what we're after is certainty too. We want to know the places we love are going to be there for our kids and our grandkids. And we want to know the hunting and fishing is going to stay good. I want to know that the house I built downstream of a new development isn't going to be flooded out because a new development pollutes the stream or something like that. Those are okay things to do. We can all have these things if we understand what the other person wants.
And so someday some young man from back east will come to Mini Glacier and stand there and fall in love.
That's one of Montana's greatest treasures. John Muir, who's a saint of the Sierra Club, said, Glacier National Park is the most sublime wilderness in North America. And I, after hiking everywhere, I agree. It's a fabulous place. Yes, some other young man will become a Montanan by osmosis like I am.
Well, I've been speaking with Brock Evans, longtime conservationist, president of the Endangered Species Coalition, former lobbyist for the Sierra Club, author of a new book called Fight and Win. Mr. Evans, thanks so much. Pleasure to have you in our studio.
It's a delight to be here and back in the state I love. Thank you.